From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, changes to Michigan's election laws move through the legislature.
I think the question that the Republicans have to ask themselves, are they willing to stand up for Republican values? Because this is fringe, you know, QAnon, right-wing, authoritarian, you know, white supremacy type groups that are taking over.
We'll catch up with the rules changes now under consideration in the Senate. Also, one Detroit chef talks about seizing the moment to expand and why she still makes time for the kitchen.
That's the only part of the business that keeps me sane. Whenever I have ingredients between my hands and whenever I am baking.
And the futurist visions of Arthur Radebaugh.
I think the term that gets kicked around for him is imagineer. So the engineer that imagines things.
His illustrations didn't just imagine the future. He came pretty close on some of the problems and innovations you'd recognize. Those stories and more coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, the strange history and extraordinary futures of artist Arthur Radebaugh, whose imagination was predictive of many problems and advances that we live with today.
They weren't science fiction. They were realistic possibilities for a future time.
That's coming up later in the hour, but first, over the weekend in Antrim County, Trump supporters gathered to repeat their often disproved claims that the former president won the 2020 election. Mike Lindell, the founder of MyPillow and others, whipped up the crowd, urging people to demand an audit of last year's vote and to reinstate Trump. These echoed calls from Republicans in Arizona and all around the country as they repeat another debunked Trump conspiracy theory, as you can hear the former president voicing this spring at Mar-a-Lago, that election fraud was widespread last fall.
Let's see what they find. I wouldn't be surprised if they found thousands and thousands and thousands of votes. So we're going to watch that very closely. And after that, you'll watch Pennsylvania and you'll watch Georgia and you're going to watch Michigan and Wisconsin and...
Meanwhile, the Michigan legislature continues its work this week on a set of bills designed to reinforce that same sense of insecurity around the state's election process. This package of bills, 39 in all, are sponsored by Republicans, and they've now moved from the House to the Senate. They'd alter a range of things, from when you can drop your absentee ballot in a drop box to new requirements for a state ID card to vote. Senate Minority Leader Jim Ananick, Democrat from Flint, represents Michigan's 27th District, and he joins us now. Jim Ananick, welcome.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
So we've talked in the past couple of weeks to several people about what this package of bills would do. How would you characterize the depth of the changes that they would make if these bills pass altogether?
Yeah, they're pretty extreme, and they're very dramatic. And, you know, unfortunately, the intent is sort of the continuation of the big lie from last year that led to the insurrection that now they're using as a catalyst to get people that, you know, largely were followers of QAnon and things like that, that are already resentful towards the government, to sort of feed off that ignorance, to feed off that fear, and to try to dramatically change the rules of how we vote. And in the process, you know, limiting our actual democratic right to vote, to participate in our democracy. It's very scary stuff, and people should be very concerned.
Can the minority stop the Republican majority from passing these bills?
We can stop them when it reaches the governor's office, and I think if the public becomes more aware and really starts to flood people's offices, you know, flood their senator and their reps' offices with calls about how bad this is, maybe some of them will start to think that this isn't in their best interest. But, you know, the governor will veto these bills if they make it to her desk. But we still have a lot to do to make sure that the public understands about how really bad these are.
I want to ask a little bit more about what happens if it does come to the governor's veto. But just to give it the broader context for a minute, we have seen Democrats, most notably in Texas, walk out to prevent a quorum needed to vote on election bills. Is there anything that you'd be willing to talk about doing, that kind of strategy to try to combat these bills?
Yeah, unfortunately, our rules are a little different. If we don't show up or if we left, they still have quorum and they could just pass it. A strategy we can use here. We're going to have to educate people both through social media, interviews like this, speeches on the floor, and try to convince our colleagues that, you know, what side of history do you want to be on? Do you want to be on the side of promoting and protecting the democracy, protecting the Constitution? Or do you want to be a part of a, you know, it's a fringe conspiracy theory that limits people's right to vote because, you know, people were angry they lost the election? I mean, really, what it comes down to is, you know, we present our ideas to people And if they like our ideas, they vote for us. If they don't, they vote for someone else. They no longer are presenting functioning ideas about how our democracy should work, about how our government should work. So they want to change the rules to limit who's voting. And I think that's really just, it's really an un-American, you know, authoritarian type mindset. You know, we don't like what the voters are doing, so we're just going to tell them we know better and just stop them from voting. It's really scary stuff.
Right. Now, the governor has said, like you mentioned, she does intend to veto these bills if they make it to her desk. If that happens, we know that the Michigan Republican Party plans to launch a ballot campaign to try to get voters to say yes. If they're able to do that, Michigan's laws would allow for the state House and the Senate to pass the proposals in such a way that they would be veto-proof, not subject to the governor's signature. If that ends up being the case, how long do you think our state could be dealing with this?
Well, I think we'll be dealing for a long time because, you know, a number of the things that are, you know, presented in those 39 bills are clearly unconstitutional. You know, they go against the very foundation of our system. So, you know, we'll be in court without question. And really what they're trying to do is a lot of their base solely beholden to Trump. They don't like the rest of these guys. So a lot of them are trying to feed into that because he was portraying, and still is portraying, the big lie about the election outcome. So they're trying to play into their fears, play into their emotions, and hope that that will make them come out and vote for them. You know, who knows if that's going to work or not, but we're going to fight tooth and nail to make sure our democracy is still here. It's that serious, and I hope people are taking it that serious.
Have your Republican colleagues said anything to you about why they want to pass these bills or why they think that changes to the election system are necessary?
Well, you get a combination. You get some true believers that just don't want to accept fact that, you know, that the election was fair, the most secure election in our history, and that just, you know, the crazy ideas that ramble around in their heads just aren't popular with the voters. And then you get some that are just afraid. They're afraid of their base. They're afraid to tell the truth. And they go along, right? And, you know, I think hopefully when the time comes to show where they're at, because this will be a historical vote, right? When this comes up for a vote, history will be watching. Do you stand with democracy or do you stand with the folks that, you know, tried to assassinate Vice President Pence? And because it's really just a continuation of January 6th. And to say anything otherwise is just, it's just a bold-faced lie.
Jim, there are some things that political leadership put forward because they feel it's important to their base and it's fundamental to the ideals of a party. And there are certain things that they put forward for the base in a different way. I'm thinking of some of the defense of marriage bills that were put forward in decades past to sort of whip up a conservative vote and maybe peel off some people who didn't necessarily identify as rank and file Republicans, but who would be motivated to come out and vote based on this issue. I'm trying to think about these voting bills in that framework. And I'm wondering, you know, that we've seen that Trump supporters, either who do identify as Republicans or who identify very strongly as Trump Republicans, have been highly motivated by this. Is there any kind of analog within Democratic circles? Like, how does this issue read with people who maybe aren't, you know, hardcore Democratic primary voters who you need to be communicating with right now?
Well, that's the really good thing. As cynical as people can get and as much as we're seeing information 24/7 now with the internet, there's still a solid majority of people that care about this country, that are patriots, that believe in the Constitution, that believe in democracy, that the folks that want to strip away democracy and some of these really radical ideas that are being coming out of some of the Republicans across the country, they're just not popular because Americans, I think at heart, are inspirational. They believe in this country. They believe in the values that founded our country. And they are patriotic. And instead of being disillusioned, angry, bitter people. So I think if they get informed about what's going on, we'll have a strong majority that will send a signal next year. But we still have to make sure that we stop this first.
Jim, do you think we're moving toward a three-party system?
You know, that's a good question. I don't know. I think the question that the Republicans have to ask themselves, are they willing to stand up for Republican values? Because this is fringe, you know, QAnon, right-wing, authoritarian, you know, white supremacy type groups that are taking over. Are they going to fight to hold it, or are they going to go along And then really could just be two parties, but it just won't be Republican Party anymore. It'll be the Democrats and whatever these folks are going to be called. I don't know. I really don't. I'm focused right now on just hoping to do my part to save democracy. And, you know, hopefully some Republicans will join us in that.
What is your sense? You mentioned the fact that we have had some demographic change in some places in Michigan that have traditionally been Republican. How much of that do you think is people moving in from out of state who are Democratic? And how much do you think it is traditional Michigan Republican voters who might be willing to vote blue in future years?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're at a sea change right now. We're at a crossroads. A lot of suburban voters who at one time, you know, because of taxes or whatever reason, might have been more likely to join Republican parties are now coming out in large numbers for Democrats because, you know, they weren't Republicans because they were racist. They weren't Republicans because they hated government. They were Republicans because they wanted lower taxes. And you just don't see those Republicans anymore. So I think, you know, we're starting to see a sea change. You know, we're starting to see some lower income, you know, working class voters that are fleeing, that are going away from us, you know, sort of joining some of this Trumpism. And we're getting some more of the college educated suburban voters. I'm obviously still trying to bring back the working class voters, because I think our party is much more attuned with their economic value. And hopefully we can hold on to the suburban voters. But it's an unusual time run right now.
Jim, for the non-engaged voter who isn't really partisan in either direction, but still shows up for the polls every 2 years, why should they be paying attention to these proposed Republican rules on how we vote in Michigan?
I think some of the real scary parts that they should be really concerned about is they want to allow for partisan folks to take over the process of monitoring elections. They want to push it away from professionals. They want to be able to record your vote. They want to be able to record the counting of the vote. But think about that. Someone recording while you're voting. I mean, one of the most sacred things we have is the privacy of the ballot box. And to take that away, that just is fundamentally un-American, right? I mean, we are the beacon of freedom for a reason. And to go away from that to more like third world type country is a big problem. People should really look into these bills because they're saying it's all about voter ID, and that's just patently untrue. We have a voter ID law now. That's not what they're doing. They're using that because that polls well. The things they're doing, if people found out about them, they would not like them.
Jim Ananick represents the 27th District in Michigan State Senate. He is a Democrat from Flint, and he's also the Senate Minority Leader. Jim, good talking to you.
Thank you.
In just a moment, why one Detroit chef found space during the pandemic to expand her business.
The control that you cannot have in life, you can have it in baking.
For obvious reasons, things didn't go exactly as planned. Warda Bugataya will tell you the whole story right after the break. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Next weekend, Detroit chef Warda Bugataya will welcome customers to a new location for her much-lauded bakery, Warda Patisserie. Actually, calling her work baking is kind of like saying that Colson Whitehead writes words or that Rihanna sings some songs. Bugataya's creations, influenced by Algerian, French, and other traditions, bring together flavor, texture, and care in exquisite ways. Fans first got to know her at Trina Sof's Cafe and Art Space, and the acclaim has been building. The Free Press named her Chef of the Year in 2020. We caught Warda Bugataya in a big week preparing for the new expansion's soft open. Warda, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You know, we could talk about your Russian honey cakes, and we could talk about the vanilla bean flan. We probably should talk about the almond frangipani with the rhubarb compote, which is probably the most beautiful thing I've seen in about 2 years. But what I really want to talk about is your Burundi tart. It combines some flavors that are familiar to most of us, but it's so exquisite and different. Can you describe it?
Yes. So the idea behind the Burundi tart is actually came up when I met my friend Mamba, who's the owner of Baobab Fair in New Center. And he gave me a sample of his Burundi coffee. And so I've always loved the combination of coffee and chocolate, even as a kid. And so I wanted to incorporate something that is familiar to both Mamba and I, which is the continent of Africa. And so for me, it was a celebration of our continent. And I wanted to create, even in that tart, different layers of textures, but also you kind of have like a hint of chocolate, and then the coffee hits you. And so the tart is composed of like a chocolate and Burundi coffee mousse. And at the bottom also, there's like some caramelized pecans for some crunch. And also we top it with a chocolate and Burundi coffee ganache swirl. And then we decorate it with cocoa nibs that's also imported from Ghana around the edges. So it is like an ode to, an homage to Africa.
I don't know why we scheduled this interview at a time when my stomach would be empty. This was obviously a terrible idea.
I am too.
You know, we just spoke with Mamba the other day about his restaurant. It's so great that you guys were able to. Do you feel like you have neighborhood friends, like other businesses that you've become comrades with?
Absolutely. And it is one of the greatest things about having a food business is the friends that you make along the way, not only in the food business, and there are so many, and I am very lucky to count them now as my friends, but then also even customers who, I mean, we don't realize whenever we bake something, like for us, obviously we are, and we want to make it extra special for all of our customers. But like sometimes we just don't know how this pastry is going to, you know, like bring some memories or like make new memories for them. And so we feel very grateful for our customers too.
Do you have a creation of which you're most proud?
It's hard to, it's like asking me which of my daughters are my favorite. It's
hard. I know.
I love them all. But, you know, my favorite is the Madeleine. It's for me, but also for me, it's personal. I grew up in Algeria, and it used to be a French colony. And so French pastries are everywhere. And we don't even consider them to be French anymore. They're just part of our food and culture as well. Like, we don't mix. Like, Algerian cuisine is something, and then French pastries are something else. But this one is my favorite because that will be like my favorite snack whenever I'll come home. My grandma would make Madeleine, and those were like my favorite with some milk in the afternoon. Taste-wise, they're very humble, but they're my favorite. Like, this is something I can eat every day.
I love that you dropped a literary reference too. Did you ever have to read Proust in school?
Actually, yes, because I did French literature in college. So that he was, we did Proust in second year of college, yeah.
So the business that you've built started out just as a sort of farmer's market concern, and then you moved into Trinosof, the art space and cafe on mm-hmm. Gratiot. But coming up later this month, you're opening this new location in Midtown. What told you that it was time to do this?
We were actually looking for a space for quite some time now. We always wanted to have a space of our own where we can express fully not only the food that we want to cook and we want to bake for people, but also the beverages, the atmosphere and the whole hospitality of that space being our own. But it was actually my husband, Mohammed, who was like also like my business owner. We came across the space a month before the pandemic hit. And we decided that we loved space and that we couldn't pass this opportunity. And we just went with it. And even when the pandemic hit, I was the first one to doubt it. But he was always behind me and supporting me and making sure that we can make it work and we can have our own little space.
How did the pandemic affect your plans?
It changed everything. But the only, like, what we've come to learn with the pandemic is that we have no control over whatsoever. And so we just decided to take it one day at a time, like, whether it is with the equipment, like a lot of the equipment that we were going to purchase, it took months to arrive. whether it is with hiring, it was also hard to hire. And so it kind of pushed us back by many months. But we, you know, we were just carried by hope and excitement. And then also the team that I have right now with me at the Patisserie were also very supportive and very positive about it. And so we just kept going. It was just like one day at a time. Okay, today, what can we do to get to that point without going crazy?
Yeah. That realization of how little control we have is can be pretty terrifying.
Yes. Yeah, it is, especially when in a food business like that, where it was literally on a weekly basis, laws were changing, even stock-wise, inventory-wise. Sometimes we would have our things like the chocolate that we use is imported from France. So now we have like this back order of like the chocolate that we use that is not going to come until June or like July, like mid-June or like July. So it was hard, but it's also in a weird way, it is also reassuring to know that we can do the best we can, but then you just don't have any control. And it's totally fine to come to this realization and just let it go.
Yeah. You know, there are many Detroit businesses we've heard from who say they're having trouble finding people to work right now, especially qualified mm-hmm. people. And it feels like the pastry that you make, it sounds like you really want people who kind of understand where you're coming from. What has been your approach to finding people? Are you just sort of working through word of mouth, or is there a pool of people who work in the service industry who are available?
I wish there was. I wish actually that there was, even with the Schoolcraft College, I wish there was actually a way for food businesses to kind of pull in and tap into that that school and like have some sort of partnership with the school, saying that if you have students at the end like who still want to pursue that career, like what can we do to support them? And what can we do to also, like, on our side, have people who are experienced? But for me, it's been a mixture of word of mouth and then also just social media, like posting on social media. And then, I mean, sometimes you will have people who were qualified, and sometimes not all of my bakers are professionally trained. Like, I'd say half is a professionally trained pastry cook, and then the others aren't. And I think it's just it's a mixture of teaching them and then being patient and then kind of repeating the tasks and the techniques. And then hopefully I am a firm believer that you can learn whatever you set your mind into, and then if you really want to take the effort of mastering that task, then you can totally do it without even having a diploma.
If you're just joining us, our guest today is Warda Bugataya, founder and pastry chef at Warda Patisserie. She'll be opening the doors of a new space next weekend in Midtown Detroit. Warda, given all the headaches that you're going through with the business expansion, is it still possible for you to enjoy throwing ingredients around in a kitchen?
That's my favorite part, actually. That's the only way that's the only part of the business that keeps me sane. Whenever I have ingredients between my hands and whenever I am baking, and I still I am on a daily basis present in the kitchen with my bakers. And if I could just focus on baking and creating, that would be my ideal. But obviously, running a food business, you have to wear so many hats, especially now. But at the end of the day, I still enjoy very much creating, thinking about what can we make, and the seasons too. Like the weather is getting warmer, and so I'm excited. I think I'm just texting my strawberry farmer every week to ask her, okay, is it ready? Are the strawberries ready? And so I am still... That's my favorite part, to still be able to play with the ingredients and then come up with something exciting, not only for us, but then also like for our customers as well.
Yeah. What kind of person are you in the kitchen?
It depends. If it's baking, I am very, I have a scientific mind, although I'm not a scientific person at all. But I do, I love details. I love the attention to details. And I love in also in baking, the control that you cannot have in life, you can have it in baking. But if it's cooking, then I am an organic kind of cook. And so I go with whatever I am craving that day or whatever feels right to me. And although the presentation is still something that matters to me a lot, I believe that like you eat not only with your eyes, but also with all your senses. And so I want to have like this whole experience whenever I'm cooking or baking something. But with the cooking, it's more mellow. It's more chill. I don't worry about it too much.
Yeah. When you came to Detroit, you and your husband had traveled around a bit after. And I read that when you came to Detroit, you started to make pastry to feel less homesick. That is such a Detroit story.
It is. And I feel like that's also like something that brought so many of my friends in the food business together. That's the only medium that kind of eases the nostalgia and eases the longing for your family. And also like my husband Mohammed is also from Algeria. So, and we were both from kind of like the same region as well, different cities, but the same region. And so it was a way for us to not feel like alone in the US, yes.
Yeah. Do you think that the new space might give you some room to make different things?
Absolutely. And we are, whether it is with the pastries, like the sweet and the savory pastries menu, or even with the beverages, like I've always wanted to have like North African mint tea, like the Algerian, like it's very common in Algeria, Morocco and Tunisia to have mint tea with pastries. And there's like a whole tea ceremony around it, the way you serve it. And then you have like the French mint. And I feel like I've never been able to have an authentic mint tea here in Detroit or like the US in general. I feel it's just a matter of dosage, like between like how many tea to actually mint leaves you use. And so we're excited about that. But then also with the menu, not limiting ourselves to what we can do, whether it is with the hours and whether it is having special events when hopefully things get to a certain normal or get better, or like, you know, being able to open later. So we're very excited about that, to have this opportunity to expand the menu and what we can do.
Warda, you got an award last year from the Free Press as Chef of the Year, and their food writer wrote in that announcement how a chef has to do all of the chef things in the kitchen, but that also has to function as a beacon in the community. Is that something that you think about very often?
I think so. It is, especially in the city of Detroit. I feel like you have to be mindful of the community that you are working at, but also mindful of the local agriculture, the local farmers, how you present yourself and how you present your brand. I feel like Detroit in that aspect is very special, in that you cannot grow your business without the support of a certain community, whether it is the food community or whether it is the neighborhood you move into. And it is important to be very conscious of how you present yourself, of how you come into a neighborhood or into a business, being mindful of that.
Warda Bugataya, Guarda Patisserie's original location on Gratiot is still open after 1 week at which she's building out the new location on West Alexandria in Detroit. Guarda, it's great talking to you. Good luck this month.
Thank you so much.
We're always curious for your hot tips on exciting things that you're tasting in your community. If there's a new spot that's opened up or a place that you really love that has managed to weather the pandemic, please drop us a note and tell us about them. You can email us. The address is stateside@michiganradio.org. You can also leave comments on the Michigan Radio Facebook page. Or if you'd rather reach out on Twitter and tag us for your best new find, find us at Stateside Radio. After the break, an artist's vision of the future that fired the imagination of millions of readers.
So many of these concepts that were just issues of a growing population, especially within cities, what do we do and how do we fix it and what's it going to look like in the future? And that is why I think that his designs are just so fascinating to me.
That's next. We'll be right back. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Wristwatches that are televisions, virtual schools, genetically modified foods. You might say that we have finally reached Radabaugh reality. When artist Arthur Radabaugh put his pen to paper in the 1950s and 60s, his resulting visions of the future dazzled millions of people every week. Radabaugh was an illustrator and a visual futurist whose work appeared in a syndicated Sunday comics section called Closer Than We Think. It debuted at a time when Americans were on fire with the possibilities of where technology could take us. And he was part of a generation of artists who depicted their visions of tomorrow, just like composer Art Mineo did with sound for the 1962 World's Fair.
And now, step right up to the next century in space. Sharpen up your spirit of adventure, because we've arrived at the Century 21 Exposition, crowded with the unbelievable worlds man is going to conquer, the most exciting glimpse of the future Americans have ever had, and there's more to come.
With a modern lens, Arthur Radabaugh's drawings from Closer Than We Think might draw a smirk or a giggle, with renderings of an underwater highway between Alaska and Russia, or a car that flaps its wings like a bat. But then there are times when the whimsy gives way to something a little more shocking. Self-driving vehicles, factory farms, and solar-powered homes. While his drawings showed us a slick and streamlined future, Radabaugh was a product of Michigan industry and rural landscapes. Michigan History Center's Rachel Clark joins us now to tell more about Radabaugh's work and life. Hey, Rachel.
Hello.
So, was Arthur Radabaugh a born Michigander or a transplant?
No, he was born in Michigan. He was born in Coldwater in 1906 and later lived in Sturgis, Michigan.
Where did he go to school?
He attended Coldwater High School, and then after that, he went to the Art Institute of Chicago in 1925, but he left there before finishing the program and came back to Michigan.
So he went to high school in Michigan, did a little art training in Chicago, and then came back and got right to work. What kind of work was Radabaugh doing before World War II?
So by the 1930s or the early 30s, he's living in the Kalamazoo area, and he's working as a commercial sign painter. That's actually his job title on the 1930 census. And so he's doing large billboards and large signs. And then in 1940, he actually is living in Detroit and working for a firm creating advertising for the transportation industry. So he's working for car industry and even the tire industry and railroad. A lot of his work is in airbrush. That was sort of the medium that he was using at that time. And this is where his creativity and design starts to show. So his early work, though, is in commercial sign painting for industry.
Did the war years offer him some opportunities to do different things?
Oh, very much so. So during World War II, he starts to design vehicles and artillery for the Army.
America prepares. All America alters its pattern of life and work to meet the demand for protection. Industry is a double step to supply the sinews of safety, the armaments of war that an embattled world must have if democracy is to survive.
And I think this is where you really start to see this forward-thinking design. So he looks at existing either technology or vehicles, and he starts to add, he sort of betters them in a way. So an instance is he designs a control panel in a fighter plane that uses fluorescence instead of actual backlight, so you can't see them from the ground.
Wow.
So it's very forward-thinking. But it's not, it's just to sort of solve a problem.
Mechanical genius joins with the muscle of millions of men, working to win for the ways of freedom. Freedom to think, to speak, to rise, live, and plan with one's fellow man.
So post-war, immediate post-war, he's really sort of stuck. Not stuck in a bad way, but because everything sort of takes that pause in the mid-40s after the war and people are coming home and design changes and everyone's trying to figure out like what's next, he actually ends up working for, it's described as a think tank in Detroit called the New Center Studio. And part of what they do is thinking about how to design for what is essentially a new Detroit. Not New Detroit in the later concept of New Detroit, but this idea of this population that we have and all this new technology that comes from the war era, plus all this surplus war material. So they start thinking about how to design for Detroit to make Detroit more efficient and better for the people living there.
For Detroit, the city of contrasts, looks toward tomorrow through the vision, cooperation, and energy of all its people.
His art career, as it had been, takes a pause, but his thinking and his design continues, actually, through the mid-40s and into the 50s.
So how did he end up doing something like a Sunday comic strip? Was that something he was given the opportunity for or that he had to pitch?
He actually sort of was given the opportunity for this. So in the late 50s, especially after the launch of Sputnik, everybody starts to change their thinking.
Until 2 days ago, that sound had never been heard on this earth. Suddenly, it has become as much a part of 20th century life as the whir of your vacuum cleaner. It's a report from man's farthest frontier, the radio signal transmitted by the Soviet Sputnik.
It's fascinating the way that the United States reacts to that, and it, holistically. So even in curriculum, science curriculum, you start to see funding for high school science labs and programs for boys. But it really changes the trajectory of this country. We are no longer number one. We aren't the first. And so there's this real change. And so he actually, less than a year after the launch of Sputnik, he puts together this cartoon. And part of the reason it's a cartoon is the medium is sort of, he's used to that. But also because we are appealing to a younger group, we want teenagers to get into science. We want them to be the leaders what eventually becomes the space race. And so he puts together, he has the opportunity to pitch these ideas and this idea of the future of America in terms of these inventions in science. So he doesn't have to, if he pitched it, it probably wasn't a difficult pitch at all. So it's just sort of where we were going in terms of our thinking after Sputnik.
Our next stop, one of the greatest galaxies ever exhibited. Here is man as he envisions himself in the space age.
Closer than we think was and still is just complete eye candy. People may actually recognize mm-hmm. some of the panels from this. I feel like they've been circulated as memes and different things people share over the years. Do you have any favorite images from the stuff that he did for the strip?
Oh my gosh, there are a couple that really stand out. I like the, there's one about, it's a classroom in your home, I think it's called, or something along those lines, which really stands out right now.
Right.
because it is essentially a student sitting at a desk and they have a video monitor that has their teacher and their homework assignments appear on a screen and they answer the homework assignments and get immediate feedback. And that was in 1960. That's a 1960 cartoon. That was pretty amazing to me. I think some of the concepts are just really interesting, but the artwork itself is, as you said, you know, it's familiar. It's very familiar for that time, but it's very pretty. It has very nice colors to it. It's just, it's really cool. But I think the ones that stick out to me are the ones that we use today, the ones that are familiar to daily use in our world in 2021.
He had a way of infusing his subjects with so much zip and pizzazz. There's this one where he shows us a bat-winged jet copter sort of mid-swoop as its owner's pet dog romps below in that super classic dog pose that tells you he's super, super excited that mom is returning home. And there's this other one where a mammoth spider-legged transport, you know, sort of a mass transit option, strides above this gridlocked traffic highway, and you can almost feel the lurching motion of this thing as it moves people above. Mm-hmm. He really had some true gifts as an artist.
He really did, and as a visionary. And I think the term that gets kicked around for him is Imagineer, so the engineer that imagines things. And he was more of a consumer products designer. He really did look at a problem of the day and think about how are we going to address this problem in the future. So transportation is a lot of that, especially when you get cities like Detroit or New York that are so busy and traffic becomes an enormous problem, if not an impossibility.
So that would have already been an active concern in Radebaugh's lifetime.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And actually, there was a design that he had for a car parking lot where you park your car on a conveyor and it lifts it up to essentially a parking spot. And that exact design is in the movie iRobot. When I saw that drawing, I was like, I've seen that.
There are some fisticuffs over who actually invented that. I know that Radebaugh put his flag down there, but suffice to say, it was a super good idea.
It was a good idea. And it does, even if it wasn't his, the time in which it came out, we see that popping up necessarily reality today, but in pop culture.
For sure.
So those do sort of recirculate as either a real item or still a futuristic possibility. He just really, I so much appreciate him looking at even food. He looked at the problem of feeding a growing population. And there's one art piece that he has about taking plants and turning them into meat substitutes. The beets to meats, I believe is what it's called.
And what a concept.
Yeah, it's very modern. And then the drive up or the drive through grocery store, the drive-in supermarket is what it's called. And today we call it curbside delivery.
Right.
So many of these concepts that were just issues of a growing population, especially within cities, what do we do and how do we fix it and what's it going to look like in the future? And that is why I think that his designs are just so fascinating to me. They weren't science fiction. They were realistic possibilities for a future time.
Stand by for surprises. The dramatic facts about coming breakthroughs in space exploration, custom-made weather, and man's triumph over disease.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Rachel Clark of the Michigan History Center. We're talking about Arthur Radebaugh, who was an illustrator and a visual futurist who used to do a very popular Sunday comics section. It was called Closer Than We Think, about what might happen and how we might live in the future. Rachel, do you know anything about how Radebaugh researched his ideas? I mean, how do you get from illustrating automobiles and doing product design in that way to futurist agriculture?
I think some of it came from that New Center studio in Detroit, the post-war era, pre-cartoon era, and really sitting down with a group of problem solvers and looking at what we need to do. You also get at that time period, and you start to see it actually in the 1957 auto show.
You are about to know the thrill of seeing that which has never been seen before.
Car designs and automotive designs that reflect whether it's airplane design and then later on that quote-unquote space age design, so you get the fins on the cars and things of that nature.
A wonderful new world of Fords.
Live a wondrous new life in the Fords of a lifetime, the finest new Fords of a lifetime, in a beautiful, wonderful new world of Ford.
So I think he's sitting down early with people to figure out, what do we do? How are we going to address these issues? And then that just, he continues that vein throughout his career, looking whether there are problems that he has to deal with on a day-to-day basis or his wife has to deal with. I think that that's just, he learns to think that way through his time with the military and thinking about problem solving there, and then later on in with the New Center studio.
Have you been able to find anything out about what artists inspired him?
No, I really haven't. I think he really had sort of his own style. You see a lot of science fiction artists that come in at the same time period that have a very similar style, but I can't really determine who is inspiring whom. So I'm not entirely sure if he's just, this is him, or if he's seeing other artwork that comes through. But either way, both the science fiction artwork that is being developed and then his artwork that's being developed really informs things like Tomorrowland at Disney.
On the gala day it opened, Tomorrowland's concept and spirit were symbolized by these dedication words from Walt Disney. Tomorrowland, a vista into a world of wondrous ideas signifying man's achievements, a step into the future with predictions of constructive things to come.
And things that we sort of see today, and even the early science fiction movies that come out, the black and white ones of the late 50s and early 60s.
For centuries, science has studied Mars, the only planet where life may exist. Now the screen creates for you the fascinating, frightening spectacle of the first flight to Mars.
They're all those concepts. If you look at them all sort of under one big umbrella, you start to really see similarities.
Heavens, we're heading right into it. This could destroy us. We'll have to get out of it.
As somebody who was born in Coldwater and came of age just after World War I, it might seem odd for someone who was to be so focused on the future. Do we know, other than the fact that there was this space race period that kind of had the whole country thinking in that direction, do we know anything about his own feelings about the future, or how his, you know, what his view was of how society might develop?
There is a person who's an archivist with his collection, and she points out that a lot of his artwork, especially in the late 50s and early 60s, actually really is a bit startling and uncertain. There's a lot of fear. You have a lot of the, you know, there's the space race and that excitement of the next launch into space after Sputnik. But you also have that possibility and that fear of the space race turning into a militarized nuclear problem. You get the, you know, the 60s see the duck and cover and a lot of fear of nuclear war. And so when you look at his art early and then even later, especially later on, though, after Sputnik, there's a lot of survival. Like, what are we going to have to live on the moon? Are we going to mine on the moon? Are we going to live under the sea? Because there's a clear thinking that we've done something to the planet. There's something wrong. And that's why you get creating new foodstuffs and in this idea of living in a bubble or living underwater or living on the moon. So I think a lot of this idea, while he has that sort of concept of solving a problem, he sort of portrays that there's a bigger problem that we are facing with this technology. And that is this issue of just destroying ourselves, whether through nuclear war or just the nuclear capabilities that we have.
I'm sure I'm not the first person to observe that what he offers us is very much the ad industry vision of things. These beautiful colors and gorgeous drawings that are, you know, often very graceful and very fun. But that underlying suggestion that farming has to happen indoors or you might have to live in space someday, it's very sinister.
Yeah. It is. And so his idea of the future, I don't think it starts very positive. I think he sees the possibilities, but I think it gets pretty dark over time.
Rachel Clark of the Michigan History Center. Rachel, thank you so much for spending some time with us on Arthur Radabaugh and his art.
Thank you so much. This was a lot of fun.
I'm April Baer. Thank you so much for listening. See you tomorrow.